Welcome to podcast number 10. Today's guest is Keith Allen. Keith Allen's an actor, comedian, presenter, and musician. He was one of the originals of the comic strip with Alexis Sale and Rick Mayall. He appeared in Danny Boyle's Shallow Grave and Trainspotting as a Sheriff of Nottingham in Robin Hood. His band Fat Les had the top 20 hit Vindaloo, and he worked and co-wrote World in Motion with New Order for the England World Cup squad. In today's podcast, we discuss Borstal and other detention centres, running away from home at 15 to France, getting sacked by Max Bygraves, blagging his way into theatre companies, working with his brother, the director Kevin Allen, plumbing, putting on the Clash's first gig, and building an 8-hole golf course outside his house during lockdown. Here I am in a shed in Stroud. It's a man shed or man cave.
Studio,
and it belongs to Keith Allen. And he's sitting here at his keyboard, pretending to be a impresario or a bloody composer, a musician. And so we're going to talk for a little while. Keith Allen, I met you at Glastonbury in about 2007, but you wouldn't have remembered me because you were just standing at a stall and I came up to you and went, oh, I could see it's Keith Allen. And I handed you one of my CDs. I said, oh, here. And I said something like, kind of, oh, I remember you when you were pretty and young and well-heeled. And now look at you. But here, this is my CD. And then you insisted on buying the CD, which impressed me because I've given them out before to other people and they just took it and walked away. So that was a tick for Keith Allen. But I do remember seeing you back in like 1980, possibly 83 or 84, at the City Varieties in Leeds.
Oh my God! Yeah.
Fine. And you were filling in, I believe you were filling
for
in
Alexis
for
Sale.
Alexis Sale.
Yeah.
And you came on stage and I think I'd seen you in The Yob, I remember, I'm thinking, God, he's sexy. And I just thought, what a wonderful life he must have to be able to mess around like that and just put on these different accents and be like Robert Smith one minute and then some football psycho the next. So anyway, I saw you on stage and you were wonderful. You were really bright. You were really strange. You told wonderful stories. You looked immaculate. And I thought, for me, that's what I'd like to be.
Look what happened.
And now, here we are, grizzled.
Yeah, two bald old kids.
And it means nothing.
So what? But,
that gig in Leeds, I remember, because it is a beautiful old theatre, isn't it? It's
yeah. Like, well, that's where they had the old... They had the
vaudeville acts and stuff.
And also the... they had Leonard Rossiter, but they had Leonard Saxon, who'd introduce acts, the good old days.
Right, right, yes.
You know, indubitable, extraordinary, yes, explosively, yeah, no, ludicrously good, yeah, wonderful. We have Mr. Des O'Connor.
Yes. Ectoplasmically.
Ooh. Yeah, and people dressed up in bonnets and parasols and stuff.
But yeah, But I was always terrified of going on stage, always, because I never wrote anything, and that was a big thing with me. I would never, ever write anything down. And I could kind of sense how it was going to go, because I had nothing to say. Yeah, I had nothing to say.
No,
I was terrified.
No, kind of
nothing.
Prompts.
I never, ever wrote
no,
anything.
No, bankers, as they call them.
No, I did have some bullet points that I could go to.
Yes.
But even I was bored of them, you know, which is why I stopped being a stand-up comic, because I wanted to be in the moment all the time. And of course, when people are paying 10 quid to see you, your moment is not very attractive if you've got fuck all to say. and what that meant was I would find other things to do, because I always believed that, you know, you are a spectacle. That's what you are. You're on stage and they've paid, they're down there, so they're looking at you. You are a spectacle. So why not entertain them? You don't necessarily have to be funny. You know, so I never had the fear of not being funny. I only had the fear of having nothing to say. That was my biggest fear.
Mm.
And when I used to do the comedy store, you know, when it first opened, I used to live in Notting Hill, and I would walk from Notting Hill to the comedy store trying to think of something to say. And I'm sure there are people out there, you know, performers themselves, you know, who know what that's like. Yeah, and you, without a doubt. And you said the closer you were getting, you know, I'd pass a pub down by Marble Arch, and if I hadn't had two good thoughts by then, I knew I was fucked. It's like, Jesus Christ, what am I going to do? So anyway, what I used to do was, you know, I'd been to drama college, which I've been expelled from, never finished, and I never went into acting when I left. I was a silkscreen printer, you know, and a stagehand. But I went to drama college just to fuck about, basically. But I knew that I had the ability to perform, as it were. So I could do anything.
So how old were you when you went to drama college then?
Like about 18, 19. Yeah.
And then you were in a band called The Atoms, weren't you?
Yeah, that was later. Yeah, it was when I came up to London. It's a punk, great band.
Yeah.
Really, very good band.
Because I was just wondering, because I was sort of confused as to what came first. Was it kind of comedy? Was it drama? Because I knew he was like, oh, that's, he does stand-up. And then you were in like, it's kind of some serious drama. So, oh, crikey, so did he go to drama college after he finished comedy?
But no, you went before. No, listen, you know, to get the timeline correct, I've been in every institution at the age of 18.
What do you mean, institution?
Well, I've been to a comprehensive school, public school, detention centre, Borstal, care home, in need of care and protection, and prison by the time I was 19, you know. So I was pretty well versed in the ways of the world, and I could compare all sorts of institutions. I mean, my favourite institution was Borstal. I was in an open Borstal, and it was just brilliant. You know, I had the best time of my life in there.
So what, because of the people that were around you?
No, it was because, and this kind of reflects my idea about performance and I guess what you do with your time. If you're in an institution, you know, I technically was institutionalised, but my relationship with the institution was, if that's there, then your job is to undermine it. So it becomes fun. You know, I just had fucking great fun undermining the institution. You know, in my own way, and it kept me entertained.
So, were you not kind of, you felt there was something about, because a lot of people, the offenders, they kind of go back because it's almost like they have some kind of structure to the life.
No, what it is it's, and again, I clearly remember thinking this when I was, I'll just put it in order. I went to detention centre, and that was 3 months, and that was hell. That was absolute hell. And I remember thinking, this is such a waste of their time and my time, because you go to a detention centre and all you want to do is get out. The only way you can get out is by behaving yourself. So you become institutionalised in a way that you can't actually undermine, because they'll give you an extra 2 weeks. And when you're a kid, an extra 2 weeks in a detention centre is fucking murder. So, I was in detention centre and it did nothing. It did nothing except make me shut up for 3 months and get out as quick as I could to immediately reoffend, you know.
So did your family come and visit? Did your brother come and visit you?
No, Kevin was a bit too young. My dad came. But my dad, bless his heart, he was of a generation where he basically sent me to detention centre because the judge said, you obviously come from a good background, you know, you've been to public school, etc. I don't want to, you know, send you to a detention centre. So I'm give you the choice. It's £140 or 3 months inside. And my dad said, I'm not paying. No, but what he thought, bless his heart, I'll never forget it. We got on the bus because my mum worked in a restaurant in town. And we got on the bus to go to court. So I'll never forget it. My mum went on first. I went on, and my dad said, two returns and a single. What the fuck? Two returns and a single. We're like, oh, hang on.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. So, but again, when I was in the cell, you know, and the guy had given me 3 months, my dad was genuinely shocked. I could see he felt bad, you know, and he couldn't go back on it.
Yeah.
But he was of that generation where, you know, short, sharp shocks, so it'll do you good.
How did you two get on as a sort of a, you and your dad, were you frightened of him?
Yes.
Or did you get on or what?
No, I was very afraid of him. He was from a very extraordinarily strict background. And he was, you know, a man who goes into the Navy. Not only goes into the Navy, but goes into the branch of the Navy that is submarines. Then, you know, he spends 3 to 6 months away, all the time away, during which time your relationship with your parent is with your mum.
Yeah.
So it's a lot sweeter, it's a lot nicer, and it's a lot calmer. And of course, as soon as Dad comes back, you know, he would want to reassert his authority. And you would switch from this
environment to this one,
and it was like, what the fuck happened? And so I was, you know, my neck was going like this, and the only way out of it for me.
Were you the oldest?
No, I was the middle. But okay. I'd run away. By the time I was 15 and a half, I was on the run in France. I'd gone.
Because you just couldn't hack it at home.
I was just gone. Okay. I wanted to be out there, you know.
So where did you go in France? I mean, did you have some family over there, or friends, or what?
No. I didn't know what I was going to do. I ran down to Portsmouth, worked on the fun fair for 2 weeks, stole some money, bought a ticket, got on a ferry, got dropped off. It was about 12 o'clock at night. Anyway, this fucking De Chavaux plied up with a bloke and a girl in it. They said, where are you going? I said, oh, Paris? That's the only thing I knew.
Paris?
And I was in Calais.
In Paris!
They said, oh, we'll take you to the road, you know, where you can hitch. Remember, this is like midnight or 1 o'clock in the morning. So I got in the front. She was in the back. I put my little rucksack in the back, which had my money and my passport. Got out, and going through looking for fags, I said, nicked my money and my passport. So there I was, 15 and a half, in France, with no money and no passport.
Jeez.
I was like, fuck me, what am I going to do now? So I'm still at the side of this fucking brilliant, still at the side of the road, and I was hitching like this, and this guy stopped. You know, I'll never forget it, a white Triumph MGB GT, right? And he's a big black French geezer. And well, where'd you go? And I said, Paris? He said, okay, good. Can you drive? I was like 15 and a half. So like a twat. I went, yeah. So he said, when I get tired, you can take over. And then this is also a left hand drive, right?
So oh,
fuck it up. We get about 40 minutes up the road. He says, okay, now you can drive. And I'm like, yeah. So when I was a kid, I used to watch my dad driving, and I would sit in the back going like this. You know, I knew what clutch was. And I would mime what my dad was doing. And the only way I could do it was by listening to the engine. You know, I knew that when the engine went, that's how you change gear.
Yeah.
So I'm in the car. The guy says, you okay? I says, no, I'm not used to left-hand side. Oh, wait. Okay, it's quiet. So I got into about third gear, you know. By which time, he'd fucking nodded off. So there I was, looking at signs
for Paris.
Yes, basically. Which is quite good, because there is a main road from Calais to Paris. So I learned to drive at like 2 o'clock.
From Calais to Paris?
Well, it's dawn, right?
Yeah.
We're entering, we're on the outskirts of Paris, and he said, oh, turn right here. So we go into this, an estate, like a equivalent of our council estates, right, flat. So, okay, you park here, I'll be 2 hours. And it was fucking boiling. And I said, well, I'll wait here for 2 hours. He said, yes, then I'll take you for breakfast and put you on the road. Where do you want to go? And I wanted to go down south. That's where I wanted to go. And I said, well, I'm heading towards Nice. You know, I knew that was down there, Nice. He said, okay, I'll put you on the road. You'll be here for 2 hours. So I said, what are you doing? He says, I'm fucking a woman. Her husband is away. I said, what? He said, I'm fucking a woman. Her husband is away. You stay here for 2 hours. So I remember it was so hot. I went to sleep under his car on the council estate like this. So he came back, and it turns out he was in the French Olympic karate team, and he was a trained instructor, and he trained the French Olympic team. And he took me to their huge sports centre, you know, just on the edge of Paris. Yeah, had a brilliant breakfast. And then he drove me out onto, So it was fucking brilliant. And I got
so
down...
Seems like you learn in public. Mm. You need, it's that kind of, you say, yes, I can do this. But you have no option, basically.
No, absolutely.
It's shit or bust.
Absolutely.
So I get that.
The guy who had the most influence on my life, when I was working at South Sea Funfair, he had a kid with Down syndrome, and I used to operate his shooting gallery for him. And I'll never forget, he built all his own shooting gallery, and he built his Hooker Duck store. Mm. And he said, you know, son, I can't do a fucking thing. I'm not trained for anything, but I'll make it work. And I've never forgotten that. I built this myself. I'll make it work. And I've never forgotten that. So anyway, there I was in France, and fuck all, right, no money. We get down to Nice, and I see there's a sign for a festival. And fuck me, it's John Heisman's Colosseum. I've been a roadie for about 2 weeks for Jimmy James and the Vagabonds, right? Because their chief roadies were from Llanelli, where I was from. When I first ran away from...
Nothing but a house party.
That's right,
God, yeah.
Fucking great to you.
Yeah, excellent to you.
So anyway, there was John Heisman, and I knew Mike Pearson, who had been roadie for Gino Washington, was roadieing for John Heisman's Coliseum, right? So I thought, fuck me, this is brilliant. And it was at a festival in a place called Biot, which is where there was the only tank battle in the south of France during the Second World War, blah, blah, blah. And it was like a desert. Anyway, I get there, and there's Mike. I said, fucking hell, what are you doing? And I explained, right. And there was this French woman, something to do with the festival. She says, you have had all your money stolen and your passport? I said, yeah, I've got fuck all. She went, oh, what can we do? I said, I tell you what, could you write on my arm in French, I'm an English student and I've had my passport money stolen, but I have to go back to take my exams. Can you help? So she wrote it all in French. The guy who was promoting the festival, he saw it. And the next thing you know is, I'm up on stage in front of 40,000 people with this guy. And the whole place was full of communists. This is 1968.
Yes.
So there were communists, you know, young communists, French communists, going all across France, going to these festivals, right? So I plotted up with them. So he read it out. And this woman had a big floppy fucking hat on. She gave me a hat. And I was just stood there, and people coming up, putting money in it. And it was fucking brilliant, right? I had this fucking armful of money, right? And I thought, where am I going to go now? And these French students, they were going across to, I can't remember where it was now, somewhere along the south of France, right? And there was another festival going on. So I said, how are you all getting this? He said, oh, we have the buses, you know, the student union are paid for the buses. And I said, fucking great. Is there any room? He said, well, you could go on the roof. So I go, all right.
So you're on the roof of the bus.
I'm on the roof of this coach, right? Going across France at night, right, not strapped in, just sleeping on the roof, right, with people's baggage on the top, with about four other communist cunts. Wake up in the morning, they've got off, taken my fucking hat full of money. So I've got no money again. I've got no money again, right? Communists, my fucking eye. So anyway,
you've still got the right to go.
But here's the great thing, and again, I've never forgotten this, right? I was outside Juan Le Pan, I'm fucked.
What's that? What's Juan Le Pan?
It's a place, you know, in the south of France.
All right, yeah. I've heard of it, yeah.
And I've got this on my arm, and I'm walking up the street, and I'm showing it to people, and they're kind of ignoring me. And there was a guy dressed a bit like you, funny enough. You know, he had a
tweed suit, braces, olive shirt, £150 designer shoes, and £8 socks from Annick.
From T-Rex. Anyway, I went like that, and he went, and didn't do anything. And I walked on about 20 yards, and he went, oh! And I turned back round. He was just an old boy.
Right? Yeah.
He went like that. And I walked back, and he looked at me, put his hand in his pocket, and he put a 50-franc note in my hand. And it was like, fuck it, I could not...
So how much was that?
That's a lot of money, you know, 50 francs in those days.
Well, how much?
There was about 10 francs to a pound, so it was a fiver. But a fiver in 1968, you know, was lovely.
That was a week. That I'll tell you, that was 2 weeks' wages.
It just saved me. Yeah. And I've never forgotten how he looked and his manner, and he just looked at me and then walked off. Yeah, it was beautiful. Really beautiful.
Let me tell you, when I was in,
I'm talking.
Just a minute. I'm interjecting. I was in Wakefield and I'd spent a whole day wandering around trying to sell a drawing on a paper bag, which I do for 30 years. And I had no luck. And a lot of days are like that. And I walked into this bar and there was a little Japanese woman who was sitting in the corner. And I went round doing my, hello, I'm Mick Artistic. I draw people on bags. Would you like to be bagged? And there was maybe a dozen people there. Most of them said no. And then I passed this woman and I told her, and I showed her my paper bag drawing. And then she reached in a pocket and she handed me £20. And she said, I'm an artist. Mm-hmm. And that's for you. And you don't need to draw me. Just take it and go, you know. And it was such a, she says, because you're an artist and I'm an artist.
That's reaffirmation.
And there was nothing, there was no other kind of message or anything. Yeah. And I just felt so loved for about 2 minutes. And I went out and I thought, well, I've got 20 quid. If I don't get another drawing, I've got 20 quid today. But yeah, those things are
it was
thunderbolts.
Yeah, and that was the beautiful thing. There was no baggage with it. It was literally just... Yeah. I've read that and I'm going to give you this and I'm going to go on my way.
There's no transaction. Yeah, and that's always puzzling because you think, oh, well, I've got to do something for this. There's always, well, you don't. There's no free lunch. But there is a free lunch because sometimes you need a free lunch. Mm. And you, well, like your mother gives you a free lunch and your dad gives you a free lunch. Well, and they got loads of free lunches. You can't pay them back. You can't pay your family back. So that's bollocks. You know, there is a free... and.
Anyway, yeah, there's the old adage, which is do unto others as you would have done unto yourself. And that's what you hope, you know.
The very first time I...
Wait, so let me finish. Brings me back to why I gave you the money for your CD. Because of that guy.
Yeah. No, that was... Well, that hit me. That hit me really hard. And I was just touched. And I walked away and I thought, he's a decent guy. You know, whatever he looks like now. You know, he's had some tragedy in his life now. And he's...
Yeah, it drives Tamsin mad because I do it all the time. I just go in the Albert. Wherever I go, if there's a band playing and they've got a merch store, it doesn't matter how bad they are, I would always go and buy a CD. Well, I've got a fucking room full of shit.
The CDs are always poor. They're always poor. The band is good, and then you take a... I remember seeing a French punk band in Leeds in Meanwood. They were great. The guy, the singer I'd like, he was a bit stumpy. He had wonderful Adidas Samba trainers on, and he was singing in French, and he was throwing himself around the tables. And it was like gymnastics. Mm. They were just pints were going all over. And I thought, this is the best band I've ever seen. They were called Le Ricochet, I think they were called. And I said, I'll buy you a CD. I was there with my wife. And because they're a band, and I could see, and I said, where else? Oh, we're going to Italy because we get fed there. We'll just jump in the van and we'll get fed. So, will you not get work? No, they'll feed us, we'll look after us. We play lots of squats and stuff. So I said, I'll have that CD, I'll give me that. And, bang, and I took it home and it was shite. It was, the sound quality was, it didn't have a spark of what they were doing. Yeah. But at the same time, you have to,
of course,
sponsor support because people sponsor me and I, and our people have. So you kind of, as you get older, you realize that we're a chain.
Yeah.
Keep that fucking chain oiled, you know. Well, that's the end of the interview then. It's the shortest podcast. We don't do these like 3-hour Joe Grogan jobs. We just do 20 minutes. I'm gonna follow up with how did you end up sort of in the comic strip sort of situation? Was it like a kind of an audition or something?
No.
Did like people like Alexis Sale and Rick?
And it all came out of the Comedy Store.
Ah, right. So
it was all the Comedy Store.
Was it Don? What's his name? Don somebody or other.
Don Ward,
yeah.
Yeah, he was great. I remember he gave me my wages and I ripped it in half and gave it back to him. Type fucker. But I loved Don, he was brilliant. But yeah, me and Alexi were the first ones in the Comedy Store.
So how did you meet Alexi then? Was he just on stage? So did you like him?
Yes, I did. But I'll tell you what happened was I had been stage managing at the ICA. Purely by default, because that was the first year, 1977, I think, 78 maybe, they'd opened a theatre in the ICA, and I'd met these two guys who were silkscreen printers, and I used to help out racking out the posters for them. And through being there, you then got part-time work whitewashing the gallery walls for exhibitions. So, you know, I was kind of getting connected at the ICA. Then the theatre opened and I became a stage manager. And what it meant was, it was quite brilliant, actually. We would put on a lunchtime show on Saturdays. You put on a kid's show in the morning, a lunchtime show, and then a fringe theatre show in the evening, right? And during the week, you would have the touring fringe theatre. So basically, by the age of, 22, 23, you know, I'd left drama college 3 or 4 years earlier and not even thought about acting. I'd never thought about going into acting at all. It was just literally, having come out of Borstal, it was something to do. I made a conscious decision, because when I was in Borstal, you had a choice. You could do bricklaying, car mechanics, painting and decorating, or an education course. So I took the education course. And of course, I'd left school when I was 15 or something. And I got 6 O-levels, you know, in Borstal. It was fucking brilliant. And I'd come out of Borstal and thought, fuck me, I've got 6 O-levels. That's amazing.
No, I had 3 when I came out of grammar school.
But look, what can I do now? And I thought, I tell you what, I'd love to be able to say, when people say, what do you do? I'd love to be able to say, and this is how I thought, I'm a student. I could say, I'm a student. it meant something. It's like,
yeah.
I'm a student. I had no idea what I wanted to be a student of. None whatsoever. But it was the kind of projected...
It was hip. Great. Yeah, it was cool.
I'm a student.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So I applied to go to Swansea for college education. And I thought, fucking hell, I've got to have something to do here. So I took A-levels, right? 3 A-levels. One of which was English, and the guy who taught me English became my mentor and very close friend, a brilliant jazz guitarist. Anyway, he became my mate, and I used to go to all these jazz clubs with him, you know, bloody, bloody, blah. And one year he said, look, I'm directing the gang show at Christmas time. Do you want to be in it?
The gang show.
I said, what the fuck's a gang show? He says, people just do sketches and people fucking sing, you know, stuff like that. I said, yeah, I'll give it a go. So I did a couple of sketches, you know, but this is... All right.
What do you mean you did a couple of sketches? Did you write something down before?
No. I was in someone's sketches, you know.
Yeah.
And there was a guy there who ran the Swansea Little Theatre. He said, yeah, would you like to join the Little Theatre? What? We're doing a production of The Rivals by Sheridan.
Sheridan,
yeah. So I said, yeah. He said, yeah, I'd love you to play the part of Acres, right? Which is some bumbling fucking buffoon, you know, it's like the comic go-to in the play Acres. I thought about it, and then I realised it was full of young women and married women who wanted to act, you know. Like, not getting there, then. So I did, and of course it became a shag fest, you know. And then David Williams, my teacher, said, why don't you go to the Welsh College of Music and Drama? Now, you have to remember, in those days, you got a grant. You were paid... to go to fucking college, man.
Yeah. I got a discretionary grant for art college. My dad shoveled concrete. I got money to be a student.
Fucking hell.
Paradise.
It was incredible. Yeah. Anyway, so I applied, but you had to have A-levels, right? And of course, I hadn't stayed to take any of the exams. So I didn't have any A-levels. So he said, apply to Raymond Edwards, who's the old boy who started in the Welsh College of Music. I'll never forget it. I went up then, I got the audition, and it was in the tower. It was in a room in the tower at Cardiff Castle. Actually, the drama college was in the castle itself. So he said, hello, young man, what experience do you have? I said, well, I've been I've been in the Rivals, Swansea Little Theatre. It was a very good company. Mm. Now, what I'd like you to do is, on the coffee table over there. So I said, yes, just stand on the coffee table. You're on a raft. At sea. Yeah, a very rough sea. Me on a coffee table. Yeah. No, on a rough sea. So I'm like, and he says, and there's a serpent coming. I'm still on the desk. And I do this ridiculous fucking, you know, my idea of a bloke seen as monster.
Petrified by a lot of this
like that. And he said, do you have 3 A levels? I said, yeah, he said, you're in. And no, I swear to you, they'd have taken anybody because.
And you lied again.
Of course, because the councils would pay the grant. Okay, so the councils were actually paying for the existence of the college. So, in fact, they were trawling with a very fine net. They'd have let any fucking idiot.
God, I wish I didn't have a Catholic education. I'm listening to this, and it just is how you do it. You just say, I did. Yeah, I can drive. Oh. Yeah, so I've got 3 A levels.
Oh, no, I don't want to bore you, but I'll crack on with it. So, yeah, I went to the drama college, and, you know, I had a grant, I had a summer job. You know, I worked at the steelworks in the winter, broke my ankle and got sick pay for 6 months. I was fucking minted. I had 2 cars as a student. I had 2 Morris 1000s. I had 2.
Oh, with the little things, the indicators
out. Yes, I had a Mark 1 and a Mark 2 with a split windscreen. And anyway, they wouldn't give us parking places, right? And my angle was, that's why I became president of the students' union. For no other reason other than nobody else wanted to do it. So I said, I'll have a go. So I became president of the students' union. And they wouldn't. And my first big case was car parking for the students. Well, no, there isn't any. I said, well, I know there isn't any. It's ridiculous. Without us, you wouldn't exist. So you have to give us car parking spaces. And they wouldn't. So, you know, twat. So I went in on a Sunday, jacked up one of the Morris 1000s in the principal's car parking and took all the wheels off and left it there. To which they said, move it. To which I said, no. And I was then suspended, and I didn't go back. But yeah.
God, and so that was your sort of.
So I'd done that, and then I went up to London. It was punk, you know, 76, 77.
And this is when the band, when you started the
act? No, not yet. It's I got up there. What am I going to do? I got a job as a stagehand at the Victoria Palace, and that's where I famously stopped Max Bygraves'
show. Oh, yeah. Right. So how did you, why were you in a show with Max Bygraves?
I was a stagehand.
Oh, you're
Victoria Palace.
Ah.
Yeah. And, yeah, I mean, he was a fucking...
So you stripped off?
Yeah, I just walked on stage in the middle of his show naked and walked around him doing a Max Wall impression. It was fucking brilliant. But I would love to tell the story, but it's such a physical story, it would be wasted on your listeners. But anyway, so I left all that caper, you know, and then became a silkscreen printer.
So who are you, 76, 77, so you'd be seeing, I mean, that was like, we'd be Leiden and bloody...
Oh, fucking hell, then at the ICA, we put on The Clash, their first ever West London...
What do you mean, we, who's we?
Me and Mike Lay. He was programming the theatre. I lived in Notting Hill, so I knew Joe. So we put on The Clash, Generation X, Chelsea... And
gosh.
The night that the...
Gene October.
Yeah, Gene October. Well, the night... Oh, Gene. Fuck you. Oh, my God.
The finest
I
cheap
tell you some stories about Gene.
And bloody... Then the 101, as you must have seen, just
Of course.
Before,
yeah. Yeah.
Before he joined pub rock stuff. Yeah.
But anyway, the night we put on The Clash, there was this tall, ugly-looking git at the front who spoke... I'll never forget. He spoke with a Cockney accent. Well, a kind of... Because, you know, Joe went to Westminster.
Yes. I mean, public school, wasn't it?
Proper public school. Yeah. Well, this kid went there as well, I subsequently found out. And...
I know who it was.
It was Shane McGowan. It was Shane McGowan. And it was the night that he got his ear bitten, which became
I remember reading that scene, the NME, and said, oh, punk gets ear bitten.
That was the night.
Horror night, blood. Yeah. Imagine somebody biting, and this ugly looking...
And the great thing was, I didn't see Shane for about a year afterwards, and we got invited to a gig in a loft in Soho Square, and it was the Pogues, and there was this bloke, you know, who I'd seen about a year earlier, who was trying desperately hard to be a Cockney, but you could tell that suddenly he had a fucking Irish voice like this. Hang on a minute, where did that come from?
Paddy me boy.
Yes. So anyway, there was that going on, right? And yeah, I was. So, and then the guy, I lived in Notting Hill, and the guy who lived in the flat above me, Colin Bennett, fucking great playwright. He wrote a play called All Along the Watchtowers, and it was commissioned by the ICA, which is where I'd been stage managing. And he put me in it, and there's two people went up for the part, me and a young man called Bob Hoskins.
Oh,
yeah, and
crikey.
I got the part.
Crikey.
Playing this little alien who comes down to Earth. Anyway, I got a little bug for it. I thought, fuck me, I enjoyed that. But then nothing happened. You know, I didn't have an agent or anything like that. And about 9 months later, there was a letter sent to me at the ICA, and it was inviting me to audition to go to the Glasgow Citizens Theatre, which was the kind of experimental, happening, cutting edge.
Why would somebody send you a letter?
Because they'd been to see the show.
Oh, right.
They'd,
okay.
They'd actually been to see, they'd seen me in this in this piece. So I looked at it, and again, this goes back to what I was saying about terror and about fear. I always thought I wasn't good enough, you know what I mean? Or, actually, rather, I always was scared of being found out. That was the truth, because I'm one of life's great bluffers, you know. Yeah. So I didn't do anything about it. Anyway, it came closer and closer to the audition day, and I started to feel more and more guilty about not doing it. And one of the reasons I didn't do, because I'm not very good at auditions, and they wanted a Shakespearean piece, a modern piece, you know, none of which I thought I was capable of doing or was too bone idle to do.
Yeah.
So I phoned up. This is dreadful. This is so bad. I phoned up the theatre company, and they were doing the audition in the King's Road in Chelsea, in the old cinema, the ABC cinema, I think it was. Anyway, this lovely lady answered. And again, I was just putting up, the audition was the next day. And I said, yeah, hello, it's Keith Allen here. Just, I don't know if I'll be able to make it tomorrow morning. They'd said that they wanted me to go in at 10. So I was just trying to push it back. I said, is there any chance that I could come in at 4? It's just that my grandmother died and I'd been at a funeral. I was just making up a bag of shit, you know. And she went, oh, I'm so sorry to hear that. Keith, that's awful. Of course, we'll put you back. You can go on last, you know, which I thought, oh, good, last one of the day. Great news. So anyhow, put it down. And I thought, fuck, no, what can I do? I haven't prepared anything. I haven't prepared anything at all. So my mate, I was silkscreen painting over in Butler's Wharf. Andrew Logan had a place there, you know, there's a huge artist's kind
of... Yeah, he
like,
did the alternative Miss World.
Right. Yes, yeah.
Did he write for the NME as well, Andrew Logan?
I don't think so.
Okay,
Anyway, we're there, and there was an artist upstairs called Hein Bonner, a Dutch guy, and his wife was a journalist. So, this is how my mind works. It's not pre-planned, but it's something happens with me. I went up there, I said, can you write shorthand? And she said, yeah, I can. I said, can you do me a favour? If I give you this pad, can you cover it in shorthand? She said, what do you want it to say? I said, it doesn't matter, just make it look like a load of shorthand. She said, yeah, of course. So she did about 6 pages of it, right? So I had it folded there. So I phoned up and I said, hello, my name's Tommy Johnson from the Daily Express. I wonder, is it at all possible? We're doing a piece on auditions. It wasn't the Daily Express, it was the Daily Mirror. We're doing a piece on auditions, and we've got some, and I named some actresses and actors, you know. And I've just realised that you're auditioning tomorrow. I wondered, would it be possible if I came down and maybe interviewed some of the directors and possibly some of the actors and actresses? Because we'd like to do this whole centre page, but it's a big thing, you know, about the audition process. And this woman said, oh, yes, sir, that'd be absolutely fine. What's your name? And I said whatever my name was. So the next morning, I get down there, and I'm the first one there, right? And I've got my pad, and I've got a red neckerchief and everything on it. And the Scottish lady was there, the company secretary, and I said, hello, I'm Tommy Johnson from the Daily Mirror. She said, oh, how lovely, and you're doing the... I said, yes. And she said, oh, that's absolutely fine. I said, do you mind if I interview some of the actors? There were actors coming in, like, and I was sitting, remember my pad, like this, going, yeah, what are you going to do, you know, and just this bullshit that these kids come up with. I'm going, oh, that sounds fascinating. So I'm getting all this information, right? So the morning's going on, and I said to the lady, I said, so are there many more? She said, well, you know, there is this guy, Keith Allen. You should be, it's really sad, actually. Keith Allen? She said, yeah. And I said, what happened? She said, oh, his grandmother died. It was very sad. Went to the funeral yesterday, so he's very upset. But we've managed to put him on, you know, last in the morning it was. Last night. I said, oh, right. And I said, is it possible for me to interview any of the directors? Blah, blah, blah. So Giles Havergal, who was the head director, he was lurking about in the foyer. And she said, oh, look, there's Giles over there. So Giles Havergal, who's the director, comes over. I'm introduced as Tommy Snobs or whatever it is. And I sit there and I interview him and I ask him, what exactly are you looking for? What kind of people do you want? What would they have that would make them different or make you go, wow, that's who we want? Of course, he starts to explain to me who he wants, right? And we go, oh, it's absolutely fascinating. And he said, look, and they're all gay as fucking tents, right? All of them. So, would you like to come for a glass of wine and some lunch, maybe? I'm going, that would be lovely. Thank you very much. So off they go, right? And these people are coming, and this is the best bit. About three actors come in who weren't auditioning, but were ex-members of the Glasgow Six Theatre, right? And one of them, I forget his name now. He's quite a well-known actor and two actresses. Anyway, she says, oh, this is Tommy Snobs from the Daily Mirror. He's doing an interview. And they're like, oh, really? Fantastic. So they kind of pushing each other out of the way, right? And I'm explaining, there's a photographer coming down, you know, this afternoon, if you want to hang about. And it's the centre page in the Daily Mirror. Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. Yes. Yeah. Milking these people, right? And I'm getting all this information. Anyway, it settles. And it's the end of the morning session. So the club secretary, lovely Scottish lady, she comes out, she says, oh my God. And I said, what? She says, Keith Allen hasn't turned up. It's really, really sad. And I said, oh, that's awful. So she went into the theatre, right? And she walked down the side and went down to the front. So I followed her in, right? And I walked down and there was Giles Havergal and the two other directors. And it was one of the other directors is the one who had sent the letter to the ICA. And she had explained, oh, there's a journalist here from the Daily Mirror, right, he's here, and Keith Allen's not going to make it. So as she walked back up to go out, I passed her, and she was like that, what are you doing in here? And I walked round, and as I walked round the front, Giles Havergal said, oh, this is Tommy Snobs from the Daily Mirror, and one of the other directors, I'll never forget, he had all the photographs, and he was like, no, you're not. No, I'm not. I said, what do you mean? He said, that's fucking Keith Allen. he then says, well, why have you done this? I said, because I can't learn speech. I was too scared. They said, well, you've got to do something. So they said, right, come back tomorrow and just do something. So I prepared. I think I read the Psalm 23 or something. Just came up on stage, but I pretended, again, what a cunt. I wrote a piece that night about a wedding ceremony, about, you know, I think a father-in-law standing up saying why he didn't want his daughter to marry this guy. And it's basically about me. And I did that and pretended it was a modern play that they'd never heard of. And I got in. Oh, I actually got in.
Of course you got in, my God. All that work you put in. I mean, you didn't sort of spend like an hour just practicing bloody...
No, but again, it was the journey. To me, yeah, that was the performance. Yes. You know, it was like...
No, that's yeah, likewise for me. Yes. I completely engage the journey. I spent 30 years doing my drawings and stuff on paper bags, but it wasn't so much the drawing. It's the steps you take to get to...
Absolutely.
You know, it's a knocking on the door and somebody opening the door and saying, my son, he nearly drowned in the bath. Can you come in? I'm just going to give him, you know, I'll make you a cup of tea. And there's no... the power's gone and my wife's walked out. But I'll have the drawing done.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and then you're in the middle of a drama. It's brilliant. And then you do a drawing, but it's the story that leads, and you don't know where it's going to go.
Here's something interesting, right? I mean, apropos, not anything particular at this moment, but when I used to perform, and in fact, I do it at LAN a lot, and I learned this. I actually learned this. And it's knowing that if you have, you know, you walk around, you have ideas, and you get home and think, fuck, what was that idea? Fuck. Why didn't I write it down again? I never wrote anything down. But I did consciously, quite a long time ago, think, hang on a minute. If you've had that idea, you know, your brain's a computer anyway. It's in there. It can't cease to exist. It's actually in there. And what happens with a lot of people, especially with actors auditioning, you know, or, yeah, performers, I guess, it's getting those ideas out. You have to relax and let them come. If you know they're in there, let them come out. Don't go digging for them and then panicking, saying, I can't remember, I can't remember.
Don't dig any deeper.
Don't. They're there. And then you will hit pay dirt at some point. And it happened to me loads of times. You'd be on stage again. I'd be on stage thinking, what the fuck? I'm fucked. I've got nothing to say. And you'd be, you know, doing something. And suddenly that idea would suddenly present itself that you knew was in there. And once you know that, you're ahead of the game, as far as I'm concerned, you know. But you just have to believe that. You have to believe it. I can't remember who it said. I think it might be.
No, that's wonderful.
I think it might be. I'll always go on stage. I think it was Harold Pinter. He said, go on stage when you're not ready. Go on stage. Just step out like that.
Yeah, go
and then you've got nowhere to go. Yeah, you've got to do it. Don't stand there like this. Going, don't. Just panic. And
just
go. Fuck and go. You've got to go.
Go before you're ready.
Absolutely. Exactly.
Yeah. That's a phrase I've heard.
Exactly.
Yeah, and it exactly works.
Yeah, yeah.
Sometimes.
There was a similar thing about Saturday Night Live on American TV, the guy who hosted it. We're saying, you know, we go out at show time, regardless if we're ready or not,
yeah,
because it's show time.
Absolutely.
You know,
absolutely.
And then whatever happens.
Yeah.
Because you're there, and because and you, the public will take you, and you're there, and something's going to happen.
Yeah.
Whether it's going to be disastrous or not, but something will happen, and it'll be complete.
Yeah.
It'll be a complete tragedy, or it'll be a complete
and unique as well.
A complete success.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you work with Kevin every now and again? You know, like
my brother.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I just did a film with him last year, La Chacha, which was great during lockdown. You know, shot it all on iPhones. He's a bit like me in that respect, Kev. He'll have an idea and he'll go and do it. You know, actually, he's not like me. I'll have an idea and I won't do it.
So how's his approach different from your approach?
I think he's more scientific about his approach.
You know. So he's more structured.
Oh yeah.
So there's more instinct to your side, and he's more. So what about the rest of you? The rest, because you said that you've got an older brother as well.
No, older sister.
Older sister. Okay, all right. So was your dad sort of theatrical or artistic?
Not at all.
He didn't carve. He didn't whittle ships and
bless his heart. He was really weird. My dad, he's very strange because of his upbringing. You know, he'd say, you're not qualified, son. That was a big thing. You know, I'd sit in here knocking about, right?
Yeah.
And I'd be playing. You know, my dad would say, yeah, but you're not a musician.
Yeah.
And, all right. You know, I haven't got a fucking certificate that says I'm a musician and I can't read music. But he would jump immediately to, no, they're qualified. He's a musician, you're not.
Yeah.
And he didn't realise it that it hurts.
No.
That really hurts.
My father was very similar. You know, he'd say, you won't be a musician as long as there's a hole in your ass.
Yeah.
And then he'd say that to my brothers, they were playing guitar.
Yeah,
he said, go on, play a tune then. Go on, play a tune. And they'd kind of, you couldn't play one tune. And it's really, takes a lot of kind of time to recover from that kind of that criticism, because you expect when you're in the bosom of your own family, it's you need to be nurtured, and that way you're just kind of you're damaged, you're maimed by that kind of stuff.
And also they apply some kind of qualitative judgment, you know, which is, you know, you can write a song on one fucking note. Do you know what I mean? That's creative, as far as I'm concerned. Yeah. Whereas they go, you're not.
It's actually more creative in some ways because you're restricting yourself. Yes. So you have to think a lot of like, you know.
John Shuttleworth played like sort of Gordon is a Moron on two strings. Yeah. He never played a guitar. He just went, dun, 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 I've been going, dun, dun. He wasn't a guitar player. Brilliant. And he'd been to drama college. He was doing all this. He was going to be an actor and everything. And the next thing is a pop star because he'd hit two strings.
I love that.
Yeah, it's you know, amazing. So you've worked with a lot of kind of music. You know, you seem to flit about from lots of things. You're a restless, and you've worked with people like Sean Ryder and Bernard Sumner, and you know, like New Order. So, and you played with them on stage as well. Yeah. And you wrote "World in Motion."
I wrote the words. So
yeah. You wrote the words. Okay. How does it work? How does it sort of? What was it like working with New Order then? I mean, and you were on stage with them as well, playing them at Reading, I think, as well.
No, but I did Glastonbury and Reading with them.
So what, were you singing or playing?
No, I sung, I did the John Barnes rap.
Oh, right, okay. Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
What became the John Barnes rap?
You've got to.
Yeah. Which John, I know John, I think John actually has convinced himself that he wrote it as well. Which he didn't. But no, it was... Yeah, it was New Order. How did that come? Oh, it came about because of the Hacienda and because of drugs.
Because you got, were you in the Hacienda?
Oh, God, yeah. In 89, 90. I was doing series up in Manchester.
Was that Clocking Off?
Yeah. Born to Run and, yeah, it was like that. It was something like that. Clocking On or something. I can't remember. With Margie Clark.
Yeah.
So I was in Manchester, and that was just buzzing, you know, that whole time.
And then there was, you worked with Sean Ryder as well, did you?
I didn't actually work with Sean.
I did England's Irie, wasn't it, or something?
Yeah, England's Irie, yeah. Yeah, fucking hell, man. That was, in fact, that single, England's Irie, Joe Strummer was on it. We were all at Peter Grable's studio, and Kermit's on it as well. Anyway, I'd written it, the words, but not the rap, Kermit. When he was in Rap Assassins, he wrote the rappy bits. I wrote the verses. And Sean's a genius, you know, he is. He's absolutely brilliant. But I don't think he can read very well. I mean, I'm not sure. Anyway, I've written this line. My wife's lactating and I'm spectating. It's a football thing, right? Of course, Sean couldn't get his head around lactating. My wife's locked it. What the fuck? And Danny Sabre was producing it. Anyway, it was the night that Bruno was fighting Tyson. So they all fucked off to watch the fight. And I was still in the studio and I said to Danny Sabre, why don't I just lay a guide vocal down and then Sean can listen to that and, you know, that'll be it. They went, great idea, yeah. Okay, keep this going. So I can't remember the words now. How did it go? I can't remember how it went. But there's me, I do an impression of Sean. My wife's lactating and I'm spectating. It's a football thing. And that's the record, it's me. It's not even Sean Ryder. It's actually me.
So it's sort of credited on the record or something.
He sings a bit on it, but think is Sean singing, it's me, being him.
And you did, and there's like the Vindaloo track as well. And I was just thinking about, I listened to that song and there was something quite strange and quite archaic about the song itself. It had a real sort of like childish sort of like nursery rhyme-y sort of, it was very like in a traditional kind of British...
Song. It is a folk song.
Oh, it's an old folk. It's
no, it is a folk song. Is what I'm saying. It's a folk song.
Was it a traditional song or did you write it?
No. All we had was Alex came up with a drum pattern. He was literally banging on the snooker room door in Groucho's.
Yeah.
And it was stood in the door that I said, "Where on earth are you from? Where from?" And he was banging on the door like that.
Yeah.
We thought, fuck me, we've got a song here. During the interim, I've never forgotten. I was taking Alfie and Lily, they were kids, we were separated, I think. I was taking somewhere in the car. And Alfie, that's, he said, me and mum and dad and gran.
Me and me mum and me nan.
Yeah, well, again, he said me and mum and dad and gran. I remember when he said it thinking, that's got a really nice kind of vowel formation to it.
Yeah.
And it came back in the studio. Me and me mum and me dad and me gran. And that's the best line I ever wrote, I think. Completely meaningless.
Yeah, but it's just it's so mad because it got in the kind of pop charts, and yet there was nothing kind of like, it wasn't kind of funky and it wasn't pop. It was, there was a martial beat to it.
It's a marching song. It's a marching song.
How does a marching song get? And it's like that bloody sea shanty that got in. I mean, how the hell? But that, and the name Fat Les. How do you call a band Fat Les? How many records, you know, who's going to take Fat Les on? Sony Records? You know, will there be at Glastonbury Fat Les? You know.
People always ask, what is it? And we'd say, oh yeah, it's the sound of a fat Les Paul, Gibson Les Paul.
So,
no, it isn't. It was a lesbian who was rather large that we knew. She'd just been on the phone to talk about doing... we were in the Star in Portobello Road, and she phoned up, and I can't remember what I was going to do a program with her. Very big in music, she was. Anyway, Alex said, who's that? And I said, oh, it was her. And he went, oh, the Fat Les. That's how the name came about.
And what,
that's true, that's absolutely
so what did
true.
Damien Hirst do?
Nothing. In fact, no, he designed the all the artwork for it.
Well, he wasn't playing drums?
No,
or...
no, Damien's never in it.
All right, okay.
That was just marketing.
Ah, right. So anyway, the last 15 months, you've not been gigging, and I'm not sure. Tell us, have you been...
I've been busy.
So what have you been doing?
Well, they banned golf, and I'm an avid golfer, so I'm sure you can explain to your listeners. I showed you on the way in. We bought my boy Alfie... he was staying with his then girlfriend down in Wiltshire. Anyway, they had an argument. And I said, all right, I'll come and pick you up. This is the beginning of lockdown. I'll come and pick you up. And you'll have to stay with us, you know, because he had nothing to do. So he ended up staying 6 months. And he'd never played golf. So we took up, we, you know, taught him how to play golf. Mm-hmm. And decided, me and Alfie, to build a golf course, an 8-hole golf course out there. My next door neighbour, these are all mates, you know, he's an avid golfer. And suddenly we opened our own golf club. We had 8 people to play from 3 different households. Anyway, cut a long story short, Alfie had never played golf. He's the only person who took up golf during lockdown that I know of. And he's now a golf addict and he plays off 14. And that's within a year. So that's what I've done in the last year. Crack cocaine and got him on
that's a big tick.
No, he's not. He was never on crack cocaine. Yeah. But anyway, Alfie, yeah, we did that. We built a golf course. Alfie took up golf, which was huge. I did my brother's movie in Wales, all set on an old people's campsite. I built a polytunnel. It was amazing, actually. Built a polytunnel.
Is that like for growing tomatoes and stuff?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
I didn't know.
That's all that food you've been fucking stuffing in your face for the last day.
We've had shiitake or something. What was it?
Shishlaki.
Keith did this wonderful tomatoey, peppery...
No tomato.
...with sage. So it was peppers, anyway. Yeah. Peppers and sage and some feta cheese in it, possibly.
Yes.
And it was delicious. And I've been sitting here... Last night I had little... bits of orange or something.
That was nice, wasn't it?
Or something with lettuce and other more peppers. And he loves his vegetables, does Keith?
Mm.
And when we told him that we didn't eat meat, he was overjoyed. He said, "You love it down here, darling." So what else have you done there? Over 50, you know, like, apart from teaching golf,
formed a band with Jam. We practice in here once a week. It's hilarious. Just love it. We're doing things like I Will Survive. Oh, my God. Our friend's Electric. Yeah. She's a Lady. It's such an eclectic mix of tunes, you know. And we played at Tamsin's birthday in the front room. Set up the band. I'll show it to you now.
Don't show it to me now. Show it to me later.
Why not?
because you're in the middle of a bloody, what do you call it?
I want my podcast. People to hear.
No. Right, new skills during this lockdown. Have you acquired any new skills?
I wouldn't call them skills, but I did put in an irrigation pump. A new one, plumbed it in. Took me 3 days to work it all out about different size pipes, pressure, and then plumbed in Tamsin's
hot in.
Water. Yeah,
so you're practical then.
I fucking hate plumbing. I hate it. But we did it. I did it.
Yeah.
I did that.
Can you fix your mortar? Are you sort of your handiest? I mean, can you get your hands oily and mucky and stuff?
I built all this.
That's amazing. Yeah, it's a wonderful room. It's not a shed.
It's nice, isn't it?
It's got solid stone walls, and it's like been plastered. And we've got old beams and bits of there's some really pretty sort of work here that looks like it's been sanded down. And I'd live here. I mean, it's a nice little place to.
That well, if you couldn't have got in the cell, that was going to be your bed over there.
Yeah,
that folds down.
So what
it was.
So how did you and Tamsin deal with sort of being at home together for 15 months?
Well, I mean, you've walked around. I've got 3 acres, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So we're not under each other's
feet. So you can kind of
Tamsin, yeah, well, I've got this. I built Tamsin a painting studio in the old pigsty. Do you see it halfway down the hill?
Yeah,
you know, she paints in there. So you're never in each other's way. I mean, fucking hell, man, we're lucky. We are so lucky. Lockdown has been, to be brutally frank with you, it's been brilliant for us. You know, it's been great, really good. And that sounds an awful thing to say, but
some of us have reaped good stuff. And I wrote a book, and I've done a podcast that Johnny suggested and stuff, and I would never have entertained the idea of sitting down with a typewriter and typing my novel.
Yeah.
You know, and now I've got my second one. And Brilliant. Also the idea of just sitting down and talking to you and to Gavin Turk and to other people.
I mean, you ask people from, you know, what's his name? From Pulp. What's his name?
Jarvis Cocker.
Yeah, Jarvis always talks about, a lot of, well, certainly his band wouldn't be where they are today if it wasn't for the doll culture when they were young.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It allowed you, you know, obviously you had a certain faction of society, oh, you lazy fuckers, get a job. But it allowed you to become a musician. Mm. Do you know what I mean? You had enough to get yourself a sandwich or something and you had time. And to me, that's what lockdown's given me.
Yeah, we've all had
time.
We've all been dolies for like
exactly.
months. And except that I know when I was on the dole, I found it difficult to kind of motivate myself. So I thought, I'll have all this time. I remember being in a job. I thought, fuck it, I'll go on the dole. And then I can concentrate on my art.
Exactly.
And if I did no art, all I did was I just sat about smoking, just going to clubs and stuff and just arsing about and doing nothing.
Nice, though.
So, but having this thing here, this last 15 months, there was a sense that, well, you can't go out and you can't go to the pubs and clubs and nice shops, you can't go to galleries, you can't entertain and escape into stuff. You have to live with yourself because...
Can I say something?
No.
Yes, just to round this off. And it did dawn on me a couple of years ago. I think the reason you'll probably gauge what I'm like from that interview that we've just done. I think I'm driven and I was absolutely... unaware of it. I think I've suffered from ADHD. Because I remember watching a programme or listening to a radio show a couple of years ago about ADHD. And to be honest, this guy was saying, you know, I'm all right now. He was describing how he would flip from one thing to the other and then he needed the control. And he got the control with drugs like Ritalin and stuff like that. And I remember thinking, you boring cunt. Do you know what I mean? He said, what have you done? Have you calmed yourself down? Why? Now, I think I subconsciously used my ADHD to be who I am. And I think I was creative with it. Do you know what I mean?
You bubbled, you were glass half full, glass.
And that there's no sin in flitting from one thing to the other. As long as you take something from it, you have to, don't feel guilty, take something from it. And it's very empowering. That's what I think. Anyway.
Yeah, I agree. I think, and you don't have to be an expert, and you don't have to have a certificate before you can do something. It took me a little while to realise that, because I spent a lot of time feeling, oh, well, I'm not qualified to be, I don't know what a G chord is, an F chord, so I'm not a musician, I'm just a chancer, I can't sort of do this because I don't understand how to, or I'm not a painter because I can't sort of do trees and landscapes, but I can only draw people.
Mm-hmm.
But lots of people can't draw people.
Of course.
So the thing is, there's a certain amount of, like, you just to kind of delude yourself and cripple yourself by trying to be God or perfect, and nobody can do everything. You know,
it's a very fine balancing. You know, I've got a 15-year-old Teddy, and you know, she took up boxing. She was good at it, and then she wanted to go skateboarding. Buy her a skateboard. You know, she wants to learn to play bass. Get her a bass. She doesn't practice. Do you know what I mean? And I have to stop myself becoming that parent who says, I've just bought you a fucking bass guitar, now practice. I have to stop myself. I think it, but I have to stop myself doing it, because there is another part of me that thinks, hang on, well, by not doing that, you might be opening the door for something else.
You don't know that.
You just don't know, you know.
So how did it feel sort of being here with Teddy and with...
It doesn't make a blind bit of difference. Fuck me, it could be the Third World War out there. They'd be on fucking TikTok in their bedroom. It would make a blind bit of difference. You know?
Right, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, having said that, I'm not being facetious, but I genuinely do feel for her age group, you know, just coming in, 14, 15-year-olds, having that lockdown, you know, for obvious reasons. They're very social, and suddenly they're not with their friends, and you know, those kind of friendships, you bounce off each other. And when you haven't got anyone to bounce off, you bounce off yourself, which I think is why a lot of kids, you know, there's an extraordinary increase in teenage depression now.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's compounded by lockdown, really. It's tricky.
Yeah, I mean, and you're saying how you feel like you've had a whale of a time, and it's like, that's a bit awful. Well, yeah, we all, I'm similarly lucky, you know, and I think, well, I've managed to have time to create stuff.
Yeah.
It wasn't a void,
yeah.
But I'm, at the same time, I'm thinking, well, there's my children who, they've missed out on sort of going to the, like, bookshop and buying a nice book, walking into a record shop, buying a CD, going to a club, just kind of flirting, dancing, getting out.
Being alive.
And that's, it's been such a strange time for us. And how do you feel now that we're out? Well, I don't know, we're not out of it, but do you think that sort of you've shifted your perspective?
No.
Since
I haven't changed
before?
One job. I think I've been in lockdown for 30 years. I do. Because my universe is that, you know. I don't rely on that kind of external influence very much. I don't go to pubs, you know. I don't go to parties. I'm here most of the time, and I'm really happy. So it hasn't changed me. I mean, I miss the sky being how blue it was in the first lockdown. I just sit out there and look at the sky and go, fucking hell, it's amazing.
Everything's so vivid.
Yeah, it's just brilliant. It's so beautiful. And then the noise, you can't hear it. You know, this is very peaceful, but I can tune into the frequency of the road about a mile away. I'm aware of it, you know.
No, when it first started the virus thing, it was wonderful to just walk out into the street at like maybe 10 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
And the stillness,
yeah,
and something was definitely wrong, but at the same time, it was this like Indian summer. The blues were blue, really blue.
It's like the 1950s.
Oh, you could actually sort of think, and you could breathe, and it felt different.
I mean, it must have been, I mean, to the power 10, what you're describing here, I agree with you, but if you were in a city, then it must have been quite extraordinary, really.
It was.
So I remember talking to people, you know, mates in London and stuff like that, said, fucking hell, man, we're walking out, it's like, well, I'm in the West End, there's no one here. You can walk down the middle of Oxford Street and there's no one there, you know. It's amazing.
It was so unsettling. And at the same time, I'm thinking, well, I'm going to savour this because it will change soon. But right now, we're in this, life's arrested. And so just absorb this and, you know, whatever. Make a little note, do a picture, write a song about it or something. But it's never going to be like this again.
Yeah.
And, yeah. So did any of your sort of friends and stuff end up sort of in hospital?
I don't know anyone who has had COVID.
Right.
Not one person. Apart from, I think we had it. I think we had it in the November before the first lockdown.
19, you mean?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. Well, I mean,
so it's 2 months before, like,
we'd never known anything like it. Just around here, actually.
Uh-huh.
We were, I remember Tamsin, both me and her, saying, I can barely get up the fucking stairs. What's wrong with us? And that was in November. Teddy was off school for 2 weeks. And here's the really weird thing. I mean, we had it all. You know, we lost our sense of smell. Nausea, bad headache, feverish. You know, we thought we had some kind of extraordinary strain of flu that nobody had heard about. But I was talking to a guy about 2 weeks afterwards and explaining to him, and a lot of people in Minchinhampton were having the same symptoms. And I was talking to this guy up on the common, and I was saying, you know, this is what we've been like. And he said, fucking hell, it's really weird you should say that. I said, why? He said, well, I've just come back from Lisbon in Portugal. And I thought, yeah. And he said, exactly what you're describing, to such a degree, they'd shut the schools. And that was in November. Yes.
Wow.
They'd shut the schools.
But they didn't actually publicise that stuff until, like, January.
No, because nobody knew what it was. Nobody had heard of COVID.
So it wasn't a kind of a February 2020 thing. It was actually happening maybe 6 months.
Yeah, and in fact, I've spoken to a lot of people since who went through the same thing, convinced that they'd already had it.
Hey, gosh. Well, listen, we're going to, I think we'll stop there. I mean, that's
been
a wonderful hour and a half. But before we do, Keith, I'd like you to tell me what has kind of woken you up or shocked you, sort of, when you musically, what's been the last thing that sort of brought some joy to your ears?
I think it was Childish Gambino.
Oh, yeah.
That single about the state of America.
Oh, is that the one with the odd video where it was?
It's just fucking stunning. I mean, it really made me go, whoa, this is. And of course, Teddy turned me on to other people then, you know, in that genre. What they're singing about and what they're saying, fucking brilliant.
Just, who else?
I can't remember. It was something, The Creator.
Oh, Tyler.
Yeah. Oh, man, I love it. I mean, just love it. It's just brilliant. It's so exciting and so, yeah,
There's a lot of strange and very interesting.
Well,
thank you very much, Keith Allen. The little dog egg is has been leaping around and licking and doing all sorts of nonsense. Is hidden, sort of sleeping somewhere. But it's been lovely to talk to you.
And you.
Thanks, Keith, for coming on the podcast, and thanks to your listeners for tuning in. Keith Allen has just recently appeared in the Pembrokeshire Murders miniseries on ITV. You can listen to this again and download this podcast on iTunes, Mick Artistic's Ego Podcast. Further links can be found on our website, mickartistic.com. And if you like what you hear, give us a review on iTunes and share the podcast with your mates. See you on the road and on the airwaves next time. Bye. Thank you.